Yesterday we heard a lot about the division between literary and documentary in papyrology, as well as the gray zone in between, and especially about the advantages that transcending this traditional divide might bring. I am, however, going to talk about something that doesn't even seem to formally exist, a documentary epigraphy versus literary epigraphy divide. One is not likely to find a book on literary and or documentary epigraphy. Traditionally, inscriptions are treated as historical documents in contrast to literary evidence, that is, evidence from literary works preserved in the manuscript tradition. For example, we learn about the cult of Asclepius in Athens from literary, that is, literature, and from epigraphical evidence, which implies the opposition of the two. Yet, anybody would agree that there are inscriptions that partake in the literary. Thus, verse inscriptions have at least something to do with literature or literariness. But before I address the literary in epigraphy, a few words on what epigraphy deals with would be in order. Greek and Roman epigraphy concerns itself primarily with writing in stone, or sometimes metal, that usually entailed involvement of a professional letter cutter and generally was meant for lasting public display. Thus, inscribed lead or golden leaves or graffiti on pottery are usually not included. One can say that Greek and Latin epigraphy deals with writing on immovable or difficult to move supports, and it is thus logical that a geographical principle is paramount in organizing epigraphical material. Within a given area, inscriptions are arranged by chronological parameters and by types, from most public, such as decrees or imperial edicts, to private epitaphs or honors inscriptions or milestones, and so on. The texts are anchored to the support on which they stand. They are, for the most part, aimed and relevant for the now and here of the moment and the place of inscribing, parameters that do indeed correspond well to the category of documentary, as we heard yesterday. To borrow from the 1914 handbook for Griechische Epigraphik by Wilhelm Larfeld, in Schriften literarischen Charakters sind dem Wesen der Epigraphik fremd. Inscriptions of literary character are alien to the essence of epigraphy. Yet Larfeld, unlike many other authors of other introductions to Greek and Roman epigraphy, actually did discuss some literary inscriptions, even if devoting only two of his 500 pages to the species. While it is difficult to define precisely what the literary in epigraphy would be, there are two areas where one knows one deals with it. First, there are inscriptions whose texts do not differ much, if at all, from those preserved as literary works, that is, those composed as literary compositions with a view to diffusion and addressed beyond the immediate here and now, which were published in an epigraphical way, that is, inscribed on stone. And secondly, there are inscriptions which might be firmly anchored in particular and individual, or here and now, but the composition of which involved literary means. These are metrical epitaphs, dedications, honorific inscriptions, building inscriptions, and so on. What unites both categories is that they tend to be studied by different scholars than the rest of the inscriptional output. I will turn now to the inscriptions to demonstrate this. The most literary, by any standards, of all Greek surviving inscriptions come from the town of Oinoanda in Asia Minor, where a wealthy man named Diogenes had several philosophical treatises carved on a wall built for the purpose. His own composition on such topics as old age, ethics, and physics, as well as some of the writings of Epicurus, were engraved in columns just as they stood on the rolls of the papyri from which they were copied, paragraphi included. Altogether, the inscription must have comprised about 25,000 words and is estimated to have occupied about 200 square meters of the wall surface. While this is an extreme case of a book published epigraphically, inscribing pieces of wisdom, which is how Diogenes' text might be called, in a monumental way per se, is not unique. Thus, in Ai Khanum, a Hellenistic city in the territory of modern Afghanistan, a certain Clearchus had a list of Delphic maxims inscribed on a stele, only the base of which, containing five of the maxims, is preserved. It's on the slide on the left. A list of other similar maxims survives under the heading of Precepts of Amenophis on an ostracon now in the British Museum, which may have been a draft for an inscription, but may have as well been meant for circulation. There are other attestations of such maxims in papyrological evidence, be it papyri, tablets, or ostraca. Closer to Diogenes' home, in Adada in Pisidia in Asia Minor, an inscription discussing the Stoic doctrine of freedom was cut on a rock by a road. You see here the map and the first publication, which we are very lucky to have because, as I said, inscription is on a rock, it's not movable, and by now there is a huge hole made in it at some point. Composed in verse and addresses the passerby. Read, stranger, and you will gain some useful travel provisions by learning that the person who is free in his character alone is free. The epigram goes on to discuss the insignificance of one's ancestry. Zeus is the forefather of all. For all men there is one root, and all are made from the same clay. For one's freedom does not depend on his status. As proof of this, it offers the example of Epictetus, who achieved divinity even though his mother was a slave. The next category of literary texts published epigraphically may comprise chronicles or historical narratives. The best example is probably Marmor Pyrium, a chronology of major events of Greek history with emphasis on Athens from the year 1582 BC to 299 BC, found on the island of Pyrrhus. The inscribed copies, both in Greek and Latin, of Res Gestae Augusti, an account of consolidation of power by the first Roman emperor, would also be an example. Part biography, part history, this highly rhetorical text served to promulgate imperial achievements throughout the empire. While Marmor Pyrrhium and Res Gestae are, or purport to be, of universal historical significance, they cannot be separated from the tradition of inscribing local narratives that relate foundation stories or remarkable events, most likely with the purpose of endowing them with significance beyond the local. For example, in 1995, a 60 lines long inscription was found in Halicarnassus. Composed in elegiac couplets, it begins with Aphrodite being asked, "What is so honorable about Halicarnassus? I, for my part, never heard of it. What is she proudly boasting of?" The goddess obliges and explains the reason why Halicarnassus is loved by the gods. It is because of the Halicarnassian's good deeds towards the gods, which she then sets out to narrate, from the foundation myth to the catalogue of famous authors from Halicarnassus, which includes Herodotus. An account of remarkable events that a city or sanctuary wanted to publicize could, of course, also be in prose. Take Yamata, that is, acts of healings performed by Apollo and Asclepius and Epidaurus. The stele on the slide contains an anthology of miracles, most with a heading. The first one is perhaps the most famous. Cleo, pregnant for 5 years. That's the heading, which is followed by a vacat. Then a miracle is described. When she had already been pregnant for 5 years, she came as a suppliant to the god and slept in the abaton. As soon as she went out from the abaton and was clear of the sanctuary, she bore a son, who, immediately after he was born, washed himself in the fountain and crawled around beside his mother. In return for this good fortune, she wrote on her dedication, and then the dedication is quoted within this anthology, all in stone. "It is not the size of the tablet that should cause wonder, But the divinity, since Cleo was pregnant with the burden in her womb for 5 years until she slept in the sanctuary, and the god made her healthy. It is remarkable that they can't incorporate the inscription that Cleo placed on the thank offering to the god. Account of another miracle opens with a description of a man reading precisely this kind of inscribed accounts of miracles. A man who had no strength in any of the fingers of his hand except one came as a suppliant to the god. Contemplating the tablets in the sanctuary, he did not believe the cures and mocked them. When he slept in the sanctuary, he saw a dream in which, of course, the god appeared to him and made him move his fingers. In that dream, the god asked him if he still did not believe the inscriptions on the memorials in the sanctuary, and he said that he no longer disbelieved. And of course, he wakes up, is all cured, believes now all the inscriptions, and departs healthy home. We get here a local history comprising local stories, all probably to the universal glory of the patron gods as well as advertisement of the sanctuary. And as my last example of literary texts published epigraphically, I would point out to religious hymns that were sometimes put on permanent display in sanctuaries, where they were likely performed too. You see here an inscription from Delphi, which has not only the words from a paean, but also musical notations. And on this slide, those dealing with Greco-Roman Egypt would recognize two of the four hymns to Isis Hermuthis from the temple complex at Narmuthis in the Fayum. Now, in all these cases, we have literary works which were displayed as inscriptions, often in places that were particularly relevant for their content. Often a monumental setting was created for the purpose, a stele set up or a wall built. Thus, the textual, or literary if you wish, is in these cases superior and primary to the material object. Or, to put it another way, the textual may be imagined as existing independent of it. Indeed, the majority of texts of the types we have seen, philosophical works, historical accounts, hymns, circulated on movable supports. Our inscriptions were exceptional cases of monumentalization of these works. The bulk of inscriptions that have literary aspects, however, is formed by metrical inscriptions, the majority of which are verse epitaphs, followed by metrical dedications, including honorific and building inscriptions. The sheer amount of such inscriptional verse is massive. 4,000 to 8,000 for Latin and 5,000 to 10,000 for Greek are estimated. These texts are subordinate to the object they stand on. They usually document and commemorate a unique occasion, a death or an act of offering to a deity. They are not meant for diffusion, and they are concerned with particular individuals, which all are characteristics of documentary texts. Yet they do aim for eternity and for elevation of the concrete and particular to the universal level. And they do it by literary means, that is, meter, poetic vocabulary, or literary allusions, to name the most important. Furthermore, they exist always against the background of non-metrical inscriptions of the same type. Metrical inscriptions are thus a product of choice over a non-metrical, documentary-like option inscribed for the purpose of identifying the deceased in the grave or donor and receiver in a dedication. This is not to say, however, that verse is just a decoration of the documentary record, because how and what kind of information about a particular person is accommodated in the literary composition of a verse inscription may differ and reflect cultural conventions, educational norms, or social expectations. Let's take a look at the most documentary parameters of verse inscriptions, namely name and age. In archaic verse inscriptions, that is, epitaphs or dedications, names of the deceased or the dedicant are always accommodated into the verse. When a name is impossible in dactylic meter, iambic comes to rescue. This may suggest the importance of individualization of the verse. Come classical period, however, a name could be left out extra mat and given extra mat room, especially when it is inconvenient, even if possible in the meter, as we have here in this inscription, where Aristocratia Corinthia is given in the prose part. The verse here is appositive. It can be seen as a kind of addition to the factual information about the deceased, that is her name and place of origin. In the imperial period, the names tend to be included again, and then it depends on the literary competence of the composer, whether he or she manages to work the name into the meter smoothly or not. Often, it is around the proper names that the meter is flawed, but in some cases, we encounter remarkable strategies surely meant to show off one's literary abilities. In the example on the slide, the name, which is impossible in the dactylic meter, Nicomedes, is split between the hexameter and the pentameter, so Agria Nicomedes. Something like this also survives in a literary tradition about the name of Aristogeiton on the tyrannicide epitaph in inscription in Athens. So those are strategies of dealing with proper names, but references to the age of the deceased, of a dedicant much more seldom, are another documentary parameter which can be transformed into literary means. Both metrical and non-metrical epitaphs of the Roman or late antique period routinely record the age of the deceased, sometimes to the day or even hour. Here we have a list, for example, coming from a late Roman Bithynia. Pisistratus, son of Pisistratus, lived 55 years. Antiochus lived 66. Glaucon, son of Pisistratus, lived 3 years. It was not, however, always or everywhere so. Archaic inscriptions never indicate age, but verse ones can mention that the deceased was young or died before marriage. Actual number of years lived start to appear in the classical period, but surprisingly only in metrical epitaphs. A closer look helps understand why such an apparent documentary parameter is given only in verse epitaphs. The distribution of recorded ages of the deceased is peculiar. I have it on the slide. We encounter those all in verse who died at the age of 9, 12, 19, 20, 24, and 30. Then we have a gap, and then 70, 90, 100, and even 105. That is, the oldest of the young was 30 years old, the youngest of the old was 70. It is not, of course, that people did not die between the age of 30 and 70, rather most did, which is precisely why it is not talked about. The age at death is not conceived as just factual information, but as a sign of a particularly grievous fate, death at a young age, or a remarkably fortunate life, death at old age, and grievous fate and fortunate life belong to conventional literary themes of verse epitaphs. Now, conceiving of metrical inscriptions as at once literary and documentary helps thus appreciate them better, but a balanced approach has not been easy to strike. For a long time, metrical inscriptions were somewhat neglected as being too poor documents for an historian and too poor poetry for a philologist. Recently, there has been an increase of studies with literary approaches, such as the analysis of themes and motifs, or investigations into the dynamic relations between literary and inscriptional epigrams. So this divide that is between inscriptional verse and literature as enshrined in the literary tradition has been addressed. I see two remaining boundaries, the removal of which may benefit our understanding of cultural circumstances in which metrical inscriptions were produced and set up. One is the separation of metrical texts from non-metrical ones of the same type from the same area in collections and studies. Although corpora do not separate, let's say, verse epitaphs from non-metrical ones, collections with commentaries and translations and studies usually do, obscuring thereby the special effort put in creating a metrical inscription as opposed to a non-metrical option. And another, more significant divide is between studies of inscriptional verses and contemporary or nearly contemporary poetic output preserved in the papyri. One looks for Homeric language in late antique verse epitaphs in Phrygia, and, let's say, in the poetry of Dioscorus, or for their relation to other poetic works preserved in the literary tradition, such as Nonos. Perhaps more remains to be gleaned from juxtaposing late antique verses that did not make it into the mainstream tradition of manuscript transmission and metrical inscriptions inside, but especially outside Egypt. Poets of towns and villages in Egypt and Phrygia would probably relate pretty well to each other, and we might do well to study them closer together too. Thank you very much.